We begin the second hour of the show this afternoon by welcoming back to the program the author of a wonderful book entitled Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination. Nicholas Parisi joins us. Nick, welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Rich. Great to be with you.
Last time we talked to you, we focused on Rod Serling's work before and after The Twilight Zone, but I thought today we'd talk about The Zone itself as we approach the 60th anniversary. And is it safe to say that much of the work that Serling did in the years before 1959 really created the path that led to The Twilight Zone?
Oh, no doubt, in a lot of different ways. I mean, he loved science fiction and fantasy long before The Twilight Zone came around. But unfortunately for Rod Serling, he just was never given the opportunity to actually do it on television. He'd done some very small-scale stuff in Cincinnati when he worked there just out of college. He did some science fiction and fantasy, but on a grand scale on the national network, he just wasn't given the opportunity until The Twilight Zone. So he had that background, and then, of course, his desire to address some socially relevant topics in straightforward drama, that was also about a time he didn't doing, you know, in straightforward drama, and he was able to do it in The Twilight Zone in a different way by doing it in a science fiction format. So he was prepared by the time the Twilight Zone came around.
The series premiered on CBS in October of 1959, but is it safe to say that essentially the pilot aired earlier on the old Desilu Playhouse, his story, The Time Element?
I believe so. There's a little bit of debate about that, but the fact is that, yes, the Time Element, which aired on the Desilu Playhouse in 1958, almost a year before The Twilight Zone debuted, was intended to be The Twilight Zone pilot. Serling had submitted it to the network as The Twilight Zone, The Time Element, and the network rejected it as a pilot. They just they didn't think it would work as a pilot. They thought it was a little too out there. The ending was a little too ambiguous, and that the mainstream audience just wouldn't get it. And so it was shelved. But strangely enough, the Desilu Playhouse, which also aired on CBS, they liked the script, and they decided that they would produce it. So it was produced, and it got tremendous reaction from the viewers, and it really did spark CBS into giving The Twilight Zone a better look. Another look, and that's what brought the actual pilot, which was Where Is Everybody, and aired in October of 1959.
And as you point out in the book, Where Is Everybody, in many ways, was a safer choice to be the first episode to try and lure in sponsors.
Yeah, it was, it was happy accidents. You know, if the Time Element had not been rejected, and one other pilot that Rod Serling wrote called The Happy Place, if that had not been rejected, he wouldn't have gotten Where Is Everybody. And it really is the perfect pilot because it really gives us everything that The Twilight Zone is about, but it also does it in a way that's accessible and not too strange for the average sponsor or network executive to get their brain around. It's a plot, and it's even the twist at the end is something that could actually happen. It turns out that this astronaut has just been hallucinating this entire scenario that we've been witnessing, and it could happen. So it was explainable, and it really made the show accessible and was successful in selling the series.
Although, as you point out in the book, the actor in that episode, Earl Holliman, wanted to add another twist at the end to make it a bit more ambiguous.
Yeah, he had an idea. And, you know, I just spoke with Earl Holliman a week or so ago, and he kind of took me to task, actually, for this part of the book because he felt that I made it sound like he really had this idea and he was taking credit for this idea, which he wasn't. But it was a suggestion that he had made, and the suggestion was that, you know, in the episode he plays at the beginning, he doesn't know who he is. I mean, that's the whole plot of the episode, is that he doesn't know who he is and he doesn't know where he is. And it turns out that he is an astronaut who's been undergoing an experiment of isolation to see if an astronaut could handle the isolation that it would take to go to the moon and back again. And he comes out of it and he realizes he's been hallucinating. Well, he had an idea that, hey, you know, what if after I'm done with this and I get out of this isolation booth, I reach into my pocket and I have a page from the phone book that I was looking through in my hallucination, you know, and Serling very smartly said, Earl, that's going to ruin this. I love it, but it's too out there. It's going to be too strange for the people to handle at this point. But when Rod Serling wrote the adaptation of this episode as a short story, he actually added a very, very similar twist where the character, Earl Holliman's character, reaches into his pocket and finds a ticket stub from the movie theater that he had gone to in his hallucination. So the Twilight Zone kind of crept through into reality in that way.
I was looking this morning at the episode list from season one. My gosh, Walking Distance, my favorite of all time. Time Enough at Last, and When the Sky Was Opened. Hitchhiker, Purple Testament, Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, A Stop at Willoughby. Boy, you can make a pretty good case that no television show has ever had a stronger first season.
Oh, I would absolutely make that case. Yeah, I agree with you. The first season of The Twilight Zone is really a sustained excellence from, very, very few valleys in that season from episode one until episode, I think there were 36 episodes in the first season. And television shows don't do that anymore. I mean, nowadays you have a Netflix series that will have 10 episodes per season, I mean, The Twilight Zone produced 36 episodes and probably 30 of them are great and the other six are okay. And Rod Serling wrote most of them, and so it really is pretty amazing.
When you move to season two, the biggest change, and people who are maybe not devout followers and viewers of the show don't realize that Rod Serling didn't appear on camera until that second season.
Right. He was the off-camera narrator for the first season. And in the very last episode of the first season, which happened to be written by Richard Matheson, Richard Matheson wrote a scene in which Rod Serling would appear on screen. It was the only time he ever interacted with the characters in an episode, either before or after. And that was the first time he was on screen. And then beginning the second season, he actually appeared as the on-screen narrator at the beginning of each episode.
Some great episodes in season two as well. I think my favorite from that season, well, a couple of them. One is certainly Eye of the Beholder, one of the most famous episodes in a classic Twilight Zone. And a lovely backstory of that, too, with a young actress that would become famous shortly afterward for her work in the Beverly Hillbillies. But we don't actually hear her voice in this episode.
No, Donna Douglas. Well, we do actually hear her voice at the very end. She does get to speak a few lines at the end. And I think she actually sounds enough like the actress under the bandages to pull it off. And she doesn't have to say very much, so it's not as jarring as it could have been if she had to really deliver a lot of lines. But the voice under the bandages is an actress by the name of Maxine Stewart. And they just felt that she had more of an emotive quality to her voice that was necessary for that particular role. But yes, Eye of the Beholder is to me the quintessential. So that is the episode. If the Martians come down and want to know what the Twilight Zone's all about, that's the one I show them, because that has absolutely everything that we have come to expect from a Twilight Zone episode.
And another of my favorites from that second season, and one that became an annual tradition in the Serling household, was Night of the Meek with Art Carney. But Rod Serling wasn't always thrilled with it, because it's one of those episodes that they had to shoot on videotape as a cost-cutting measure.
Exactly. Yeah, there were six episodes that were shot on videotape in the second season. And for anybody who, it's one of those frequently asked questions that people see those episodes and they say, what's going on here? Because it just looks completely different from all the other episodes of the series. And the reason was because, yes, it was shot on videotape, and it gives a completely different look to the show. And Night of the Meek happened to be one of those. And when the initial rushes or dailies were coming through with Night of the Meek, Rod Serling was very, very disappointed in it. He thought it was coming out terribly. And even after it aired, I'm not sure that he was all that happy with it. But over time, apparently his opinion changed on it, because he did show it to his daughters and their friends every Christmas. And he did much later in his life say that it was one of his favorites. And Art Carney was one of Rod Serling's favorite actors, if not his favorite actor. And he's just tremendous in that episode.
We're talking with Nick Parisi, the author of Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination. Season three of The Twilight Zone, certainly the toll was beginning to catch up with Rod Serling at this point, but still some wonderful episodes. It's a Good Life, the harrowing episode with the young Billy Mumy, To Serve Man, one of the great episodes of all time. And for me, what I think is the scariest Twilight Zone episode of all, Little Girl Lost.
Oh, really? Wow. Well, that's, yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the classic episodes, but yeah, it's, I think it's probably scary in a very unnerving way. I mean, especially if you happen to have a daughter, and, you know, you can imagine yourself in this scenario of, you know, the episode, of course, is, you know, a little girl rolls off the bed and rolls through the wall into another dimension, and the father, the parents are, you know, they are trying to grab her back from the other dimension, can't find her, and hearing her cry from another dimension and not being able to reach her, and that, yeah, that is certainly very unnerving. There, you know, the Twilight Zone, you know, people find it scary, of course. You know, it is a very unnerving, a very creepy show. So you kind of get you get arguments about what the scariest episode of the series was. I mean, there certainly were plenty to choose from.
Well, yeah, and being a little kid at the time, around the same age, a little bit younger than Billy Mumy, I never wanted to encounter him anywhere after that episode.
I'm sure, and probably even more so when you saw It's a Good Life. And it's, you know, that's probably his most well-known known episode.
Now, going into season four, the Twilight Zone was in trouble, and they ended up using it as a mid-season replacement. But because of that, the decision was made to go to hour-long episodes. That just didn't quite work out, did it?
It didn't work out, no, but the strange thing about that, or the ironic thing, is a couple of ironies about that. One is that, you know, Rod Serling really envisioned The Twilight Zone as an hour-long series from the beginning. He pitched it as an hour-long series, and he always really wanted an hour-long series. The time element was an hour-long. The first pilots that he wrote, the first pilot, The Happy Place, was intended to be an hour-long. So he always had in mind to do an hour show, and he kind of reluctantly agreed to do it as a half-hour from the get-go, and obviously it worked. But what happened was, even after the second season, believe it or not, the network was starting to say to Rod Serling, maybe we should do this as an hour. They were kind of pushing it a little bit, and Serling still had his you know, he was in the back of his mind, he still wanted that bigger canvas to create. You know, he wanted more room, more time to develop characters, and he obviously didn't do it for the third season. But in between the third and the fourth, when it wasn't renewed immediately, the conversation began again about maybe we'll do this as an hour. And it wasn't, you know, it was kind of a mutual thing between Serling and the network. And they gave it a shot, and it didn't work. For most fans, those hour-long episodes are padded. They just don't quite work as well as the half-hour episodes. And so it was an experiment that didn't quite work out. And then they went back to the half-hour for the last fifth season.
There are still some great moments, though, in that fourth season. From your perspective, what's the best of the hour-long Twilight Zones?
My particular, I have two favorites from the fourth season. One is On Thursday We Leave for Home, starring James Whitmore, about a group of colonists from Earth that go to another planet to basically escape the terrible environment on Earth. And they want to come back. They want to come home. They've been away for too long, and they finally realize they want to come home. And it's about this man who's held this community together on another planet for so long, and now all of a sudden they're going to go home, and he's going to lose them. And how does he deal with that? It's a great character study, and it's a beautiful piece of writing from Serling. That's certainly one of my favorites. My other favorite is one called The New Exhibit, which Stephen King called this the closest that The Twilight Zone ever got to true horror, just pure horror. It's about a man with a wax museum. He becomes enamored with these wax figures, and the wax museum is going to close, so he takes the wax figures and keeps them in his basement, and they come to life, essentially, and start committing murders. And I think that's a really, really good and underrated episode.
And even in season five, as the show was wrapping up, and we talked with you, there were discussions about a sixth season, but some of the most celebrated episodes of all time in that final year, including William Shatner's unforgettable appearance in Nightmare at 20,000 Feet.
Yeah, the fifth season is very strange to when you take it kind of episode by episode. The fifth season has a couple, as you mentioned, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, undisputed classic of the series. It also had, the fifth season also had Little Girl Lost with Talking Tina. I'm sorry. The Living Doll with Talking Tina was in the fifth season.
With Telly Savalas. Oh, my word.
Yeah, with Telly Savalas, yeah. In Praise of Pip is one of my favorites, with, yes, again, Billy Mumy and Jack Klugman. That was the first episode of the fifth season, one of my favorites. So the fifth season has some really, really classic and really good episodes, and then it has the absolute worst of the series. If you were to pick the 10 worst episodes of the series, I think you could probably get 8 of them out of the 5th season, if not all 10. So it really had the biggest gap between really good and really bad in that particular season.
I want to ask you about the bad in a moment, but you mentioned In Praise of Pip, and as I recall, too, that was the first network television show that made any reference to the Vietnam War that at that point was still a conflict with some advisors there.
It was 1964. I mean, way ahead of any other television series. Rod Serling, you know, at least addressed it. He at least mentioned it. And the Jack Klugman character says there isn't even supposed to be a war there. You know, his boy is dying, and there isn't supposed to be a war there. So this was early on in the conflict. As you said, we just had advisors on the ground there, supposedly, and this happened. So yeah, that's an historic episode just for that reason.
All right, now for me, the worst ever is The Bewitching Pool. What's your least favorite episode of all time?
Well, that happens to be the very last episode of the series, The Bewitching Pool, and that, you know, so it really went out on a whimper, and I would agree that that's one of the worst, for sure. My least favorite is another 5th season episode called Come Wander With Me.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Oh, horrible. And every time I mention this episode, people ask me to describe it, and I say, you know, it's so bad I can't even describe it. I can't even really give you the plot of it, because it really doesn't even make sense, even in a Twilight Zone sense. It's just awful. That's definitely my least favorite.
Rod Serling went back to actors that he had great respect for and who worked well in the show, I think especially of Burgess Meredith, Jack Klugman, but there were a number of them who did multiple episodes. Who do you think is the quintessential Twilight Zone actor?
You know, it's so hard because the two that come that are certainly in vying for the lead are Burgess Meredith and Jack Klugman. Now, they're the two that starred in 4 episodes apiece. And I think they both kind of exhibit these qualities that Serling was always going for. I would give the edge to Jack Klugman. I think Jack Klugman embodies that everyman quality a little bit more than Burgess Meredith did. Burgess Meredith could play kind of the nebbish more than Jack Klugman could, but I think Jack Klugman really is the quintessential actor for the Twilight Zone. And since you mentioned it, you know, we're going to be celebrating the 60th anniversary this year at something called Serling Fest in Binghamton, New York, in Rod Serling's hometown. And right now we're doing a vote online at rodserling.com where people can vote for best actor, best actress, and best episode and all of these things. And it's going to be the first official vote for these things, and we're gonna present the awards at Serling Fest, and you know, be the first official award sanctioned by the Serling Estate and the Rod Serling Memorial Foundation, and it'll be fun to see what people come up with. But Jack Klugman will certainly be one of the choices for best actor.
Well, let's talk more about Serling Fest. It's coming up the first weekend in October, and boy, you've got a stellar cast of presenters. Can you talk a little more about what people will see if they make the trip to Binghamton?
Yeah, I'd love to. It's going to be October 4th, 5th, and 6th, so it's the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The 60th anniversary is October 2nd of 2019 is the 60th anniversary. And we're going to be doing it at 3 different locations. So if you go to rodserling.com, you can get the information on the locations. The main location will be Saturday at the Forum Theater in Binghamton. And we have 11, at my last count, 11 different writers who have written books, substantial books, about Rod Serling or the Twilight Zone or Night Gallery. And you know, so we're going to have presentations, readings, and signings from pretty much all of them. Mark Dowidziak will be there. He wrote Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone. Scott Skelton will be there. He wrote the only Night Gallery reference guide called An After Hours Tour, Rod Serling's Night Gallery. And this year is actually the 50th anniversary of the Night Gallery premiere in 1969. So we'll be celebrating that as well. And so people will be able to see the authors, interact with the authors. I mentioned The Happy Place earlier, one of the unproduced pilots. Well, we're going to have a dramatic reading of that script for the first time ever. People will be able to hear that script and performed as a dramatic reading. That'll be on the Friday night. So that's one of the things. We're going to have Twilight Zone trivia and the award ceremony. It's going to be a great time.
Well, we've got it circled on our calendar, and we're hoping to make it out there. It's a long journey, but it would be well worth it to be out there for Serling Fest on this 60th anniversary of the Twilight Zone.
I hope you can make it, Rich. That would be great.
And Nick, always great to talk with you. Thanks again for making time for us, and, well, hope to see you out there in Binghamton this fall.
I hope so. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Nicholas Parisi, author of Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination.